I've thought a lot about why he went to India at this particular time. He'd always wanted to go back to India, as any person would. I mean, you want to go back to your native land, of course, and especially somebody who had such a... he lived in such a romantic India, Murshid did. It was very idealized in his imagination. And so he always longed to return. His only trip back to India since he left in 1910. He was in the West for 16 years. But why at this particular point? Why did he go with only his secretary, Kismet, and nobody else? And why didn't he tell anybody he was going to India? I don't know if you know this, but his journey there was secret. Nobody knew about it except his immediate family. And so all of these whys kept occurring to me. I mean, why, especially if he thought he was going to die, surely he would have taken his family with him. He wouldn't leave his wife and four children and go off to die in some other country. Doesn't make any sense to me. And finally it dawned on me what the reason was. The clue is given by Kismet Stamm, who traveled with him and who had to pose as his wife while they were traveling around India, because otherwise a man and a woman couldn't travel together like that in India. She says, every place that they went, the first thing they did was to go to doctors. And finally the light bulb went off and I said, ah, I see. He had chronic pneumonia. Allopathic medicine had nothing to help with pneumonia. Before antibiotics, there was nothing to do. And so he went there in hopes that he would find an Ayurvedic doctor who would be able to cure him from his pneumonia. And he constantly went to visit doctors looking for somebody who would be able to do this. He didn't tell anybody he was going because his followers were people of means. And if they'd found out that he was going to India, they would have gone to India too. And the last thing in the world he wanted was a bunch of followers traipsing around after him when he went around in India. The two of them went by themselves, traveled around quite a bit. They landed in Lahore and then proceeded to India. Of course, it was all one country in those days. And proceeded to Baroda, where he visited the family house, but he didn't stay there very long. His only interest was to go to the grave of Mulabash, his grandfather. And then they proceeded on to Delhi, which seemed to be his real goal, although he had no particular connection with Delhi before this. And he particularly wanted to be in the area called Nizamuddin Aulia, the Darga of one of the greatest Sufi saints in India. I would say he's the second Sufi saint after Moinuddin Chishti, whose Darga is in Ajmer and is the greatest pilgrimage center in India. Every year, during the Urs of Moinuddin Chishti, more than 1 million people come to his Darga. And they're not all Muslims. Hindus, Christians, others come to the Darga as well. Although it's a very difficult place to visit. I mean, it's I won't go into the details, but just believe me, it's not just fun to go there. It's hard and difficult, but quite a powerful place. Fortunately for these huge crowds, Moinuddin Chishti's Urs lasts for 6 days instead of 1 day, and the reason for that is that he announced that he was going on retreat and had himself shut into this little hut for 6 days, and when they opened the hut, he was dead. So nobody knows on which day he died, so they celebrate these 6 days as his worst. So not all 1 million people have to be there at one time, but it is very crowded, and it's not quite the Kumbh Mela, but it's a scene, shall we say. But Nizamuddin Aulia, who was his second successor, His immediate successor was a man named Bakhtiar Khaki, whose tomb is in Delhi near the Qutub Minar. And then Nizamuddin Aulia, who lived in this part, well, it wasn't part of Delhi, actually, when he lived there. It was well outside of Delhi, but now it's part of Delhi. And he lived there and gathered a huge community of followers around him. There's a delightful story, which is that, Nizamuddin Aulia ordered them to dig a big water tank in there to supply water to the community. It's still there. You can see it. People swim in it now. It's not the water supply anymore, but it's still there. And many of his followers worked for the king at that time. And so they would go and work for the king all day long, and then at night they would come and work on digging this tank. And the king heard about it and was outraged. He said, well, no wonder these lazy bums never get anything done. They're up all night digging this tank. And sent his army with orders to arrest Nizamuddin Aulia. And while the army was on its way, because for an army it took more than a day to get to where Nizamuddin Aulia was, someone informed Nizamuddin Aulia that this was coming. And Nizamuddin seemed completely unconcerned and said, Delhi is far away. Well, it so happened that before the army got to where Nizamuddin Aulia was, the king suddenly died and the army was withdrawn. And this is still a very popular saying in India today. Delhi is far away, meaning the government and the administration has nothing to do with me. You know, don't bother me. So, it's far away. This is the area where Inayat Khan hung out when he was in Delhi. He used to go there to meditate every day, and there was this particular little cemetery there with a kind of tree. I forget the name of it. I learned this in February, but I've already forgotten, but I have notes about it. Particular kind of tree that particularly grows in cemeteries in India, and he used to like to go and sit under this particular tree and meditate. He became good friends with the man who was the imam of that darga, and they used to often go up in a tower together that's part of the complex. And one day, Murshid said, looking out over the cemetery where he liked to sit, he said, I should like to stay here forever. Mm-hmm. Well, when he died a few weeks later, this was the only clue that they had about what to do with his remains. Mm-hmm. And so Kismet Stam arranged for the plot of land right around that tree to become his burial place, his darga. And the tree is still part of the complex. It's huge now, mm-hmm. Very, very big tree. And of course it won't live forever. So far it seems quite healthy, and it grows there. And sitting with your back to the tree is by far the best place in that darga. It's very charged, magnetic, and of course the darga has grown into something much, much larger than it was. It was originally just a little canopy, and now it's a whole big complex, and quite a well-developed place, thanks to a lot of effort and money, particularly by people from the Sufi movement, Karim Bash Vidavain and others. A beautiful place to go. The one kind of drawback in my mind is that they don't allow Indians to go there.
Huh? What?
You're surprised at this. Well, it's in the middle of a very... Nizamuddin Aulia, the neighborhood, is a very, very poor neighborhood. You would call it a slum. The people are very, very poor. And if they were allowed to go in there, they would live there in great numbers. And so they've had to be very, very restrictive about who is allowed to go in there. Indians can go in there when there's a public ceremony and a lot of people there. But other times it's just locked and there's a guard and you can't go in unless you're white. basically, I guess you would say, which is, I think, is very unfortunate. I mean, it's exactly the opposite of Murshid, who was not white, in fact, the people in the neighborhood, sometimes I talk to them just to see, you know, what they think about all this, and I say, well, you know, what do you think about this this darga? And they say, oh, that place, it has no heart. Mm. Exactly the opposite of the impression that it should give. Mm. And I think this is a problem to be solved. Mm. I think somehow we have to get the heart that is there to express itself to the local people around there. But, you know, it's a really, really, really poor area. The people who live there have nothing. Of course, now Pir Vilayat's darga is also next door in the same area. The Hope Project building is there, and they do a lot, of course, for the neighborhood. They train young people in various possible trades. And nobody would say the Hope Project has no heart, but it's not the darga. The darga is down the street away from the Hope Project, and they're not necessarily associated in the minds of the people. When he was looking for quarters in Delhi, he didn't get anything near Nizamuddin Aulia for some reason. I have no idea what his thinking was, but he took a house several miles north of that area along the Jumna River, next to a beautiful garden and an ancient crumbling mosque where he used to like to go and meditate. Now, I did get to visit the house. The people who were occupying the house were followers of Sai Baba, but they were very sympathetic, and they knew about the history, and they welcomed us into the house and gave us tea and so forth. And then I figured out which room it was in which Murshid died. And there's a story from the time when he died, that the room was filled with the smell of roses, mm-hmm. overpowering smell of roses. And I stepped into that room, and I smelled roses. Mm-hmm. There were no roses around anywhere. I smelled them really strongly still all these years later. I don't think there's any particular reason to acquire the house and make it a shrine, but it still was a special place that I felt very glad that I'd had the opportunity to visit. There's a funny story about the lodge, which is that it belonged to a pharmacist, and Murshid went to him and inquired about renting it, and the man gave him a price, and he said, well, I'll think it over, and went away. And a week later he decided that he would take it, so he went back and he said, well, I've decided to take the house, and the man said, oh, fine, and gave him a price which was twice as much as what he had paid the week before. and Murshid said, but I asked you last week, and you said this price. And the man said, you should have taken it then. But in any case, Murshid paid whatever it was that it cost, and he lived there with Kismet and a couple of servants. And his death occurred rather suddenly. Kismet says he showed no outward signs of illness, but he simply went to bed one night, the 3rd of February, and then he stayed in bed the whole day, the next day, and then on the morning of the 5th of February, he went into what they call agonic breathing, death rattle, and breathed that way for 8 hours, and then died. When the news came back to Europe that Murshid had died in India, I mean, people were just totally bewildered. I mean, they had no idea he was in India, and they had no idea that he might die. I mean, it was like the rug had been pulled out from under them. I mean, what had come to be the center of their lives suddenly disappeared just like that. And people were just bewildered. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know what to make of it. And, not the least his family, who, as I already mentioned, went there the year afterwards but had a very difficult time. And things in the organization were very chaotic. Some people withdrew altogether. Rabia Martin, for example, when she went and wasn't accepted, just went back to San Francisco and did her own thing for the rest of her life. But others were that way. Also, Baron von Toil withdrew from the organization. He said, well, nobody can succeed Mershit, so he just went and did his own thing. And a number of others as well broke up. It was very chaotic. And finally, after 2 years, they settled on Mahbub Khan, the older of his two younger brothers. They settled on him to lead the organization, and Rashida Goodenough put her stamp on it. And then it was a fait accompli. But he was not a charismatic speaker like Mershit, and it was a matter of just kind of trying to hold things together, and which he did in an admirable way, but still, you know, he didn't have that kind of magnetic power that Mershit had. And people weren't ready to be told that this was their job now to carry on. They had the idea that they would have a nice long life with Mershit talking to them, talking them through it, and then suddenly that just wasn't there anymore.
The second biography that's underneath there, the yellow one, if I recollect, there is a little sharing of a dream that Nuranisa had.
Yes,
just
the baker
exactly,
flew away.
Exactly.
And why the baker?
Yes.
But the Begum's family name was Baker, not Mershit, so that might have something to do with it. I don't know. Well, I'll tell you how it is. In retrospect, the family found many signs that Mershit knew he was going to die and went off to do it in that way. The Begum, as I told you, never believed that he died. She thought he went off into the forest.
But this was Nuranisa.
Yeah, that was Nuranisa. And there are many other stories as well. People, you know, indications that he knew he was going to die because... And this is, again, a doctored photograph. This is a photograph that was taken by Hyatt Stadlinger. But in the original photograph, down where you can't see, there was a white chalk circle that somebody had put on the ground to show Mershit where he was supposed to stand during the ceremony. Mershit walked over and he looked and he saw the circle and he looked really startled. And then with an air of extreme resignation stepped into the circle because the symbolism of the closed circle meant death. So when I said that I don't think he knew he was going to die when he went to India, for a lot of reasons, I don't think so. But nevertheless, he knew at some level of his being that that death was approaching. He didn't know when exactly or under what circumstances. And this piece of symbolism just confirmed that. But they've taken it out of this photograph. Well, there's a kind of a story that bounces around that people of a very high spiritual status get to choose their own death. They don't, you know, it's not something that just happens to them. They decide when they're going to die. And so the idea is that, you know, it couldn't have just happened that Mershit went to India and instead of getting cured, he died. That would not be acceptable scenario. And so they found many things that they regarded as indications or adumbrations or foreshadowings of his death. But I think they're all, sort of filling in the blanks because they didn't have any other way to fill them in. They couldn't understand what had happened in any other way than assuming that he knew about this. But I see no indication whatsoever that he knew about it or anticipated it, even up to the very last week of his life. Kismet doesn't give any indication that. The one thing is they went to the Jama Masjid for the prayers, that huge mosque in the middle of of Delhi built by Shah Jahan, and where 100,000 people gathered for the prayers. And when they were coming out of the mosque, going down the stairs, it has a huge stairway leading up to it, they were coming down the stairs, and some wild dervish type person came up to Murshid and said, "I have been called to the court. I have been called to the court." And Kismet asked Murshid, he said, "Well, what did he mean by that?" And Murshid said, "You'll see." So that was about a week before he died. So maybe at that point he knew. But if he did know, he didn't communicate with people, his wife, his family, he didn't say anything about it. He didn't send out the letters of apology to everyone that Sufi teachers send out when they know they're going to die. I mean, I see no indication that he knew he was going to die.
Which is not to say that somebody else might not have had a foreshadowing.
That's true.
I mean,
yeah.
In some mm-hmm. realm of
yes, yeah, very, very possible. Okay, I think we have another 15 minutes, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Yes, you said earlier that the message volumes were inaccurate. And I have two questions. I've heard that the message volumes were formed from the notes student took of Murshid's No. What were the message volumes based on, and could you name just one or two of the most egregious inaccuracies?
Oh, okay, sure. They were based on, well, in the first place, the books that Murshida Goodenough had edited for Murshid. Those are the early books. You can find those for sale if you want, and they're much less edited than the Sufi message volumes. Murshid appointed Murshida Goodenough to edit his material for distribution, that is to say, Gatha, Gita, and so forth, and social Gatikas and religion. All those things were edited by Murshida Goodenough, who was an excellent editor and already began editing his material in London in 1916. So she was his lifelong editor, and he approved of her very highly. She was a completely brilliant woman who was the daughter of a general in England, and her mother was a Habsburg princess. So she was aristocratic and, you know, from the extremely well educated. She was fluent in Persian. She and Murshid used to speak Persian at the dinner table. Nobody else knew any Persian, so they had their own little secret language there going. She was the closest person to Murshid. But she was also a kind of a personality opposite to Murshid. She was aloof and remote. And the other Marids didn't know her. She wasn't interested in anybody, interacting with anybody. Quite different from Murshida Green, for example, was a very warm personality. But she was very close to Murshid, his closest Marid in many ways, and his designated editor. He always praised her editing very much. So she edited things in a way that was certainly acceptable to Murshid. But then the man who put together the Sufi message volumes, whose name was Huzur Nawaz van Palant, a Dutchman, a baron. Many of Murshid's followers were from the aristocratic class. Almost all of them were rich, because, who would be able to come to Suren for 3 months every summer to listen to Murshid? I mean, if you had a job, children, anything like that, you couldn't do that unless you were of the moneyed class, where somebody else would take care of your children, and, you know, you could do whatever you wanted. And those were the kinds of people who followed Murshid. They were also the kinds of people who were interested in the East. It was the upper classes that had this fascination with things Eastern. You know, the working class wasn't interested in the East. It was only these leisure class people who had these interests.
Are you saying that Murshid did not read over pre-publication?
Never. No, never. Yeah.
I'm a little bit confused. Okay, so if they copied down his lectures
yeah.
in shorthand,
yes.
in like in September, and then they made them into a book in December.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're going back over their notes.
We don't have their notes for The Inner Life.
So how are you getting...
We only have the published book. That's the manuscript of The Inner Life. We have nothing, no manuscripts of that.
So how are you going back over and saying, this is not, this is what he said and this is what... Where are you
For most of the lectures, we have the shorthand of Sakina Fournet. We still have that shorthand. We retranscribe it into English. We don't even rely on her own transcription. We go over it again from scratch. Yeah. And transcribe it so that we see exactly what he actually said. And then we can compare it to the form in which it was distributed in the case of, you know, the papers for centers or published in books. We can compare it exactly. In The Inner Life, we can't do that. We don't have the manuscripts. They were probably disposed of.
So you're going back to the original shorthand?
Yes. Yes.
The series of the Gatha, Gita, and Sangha.
No, those were edited by Murshida Goodenough herself, mostly dictated to her, and she actually edited as they were being dictated. That is to say, she took them down as Murshid was speaking. It was just the two of them there, and very often you see things crossed out, which means that Murshid changed his idea about the way he was going to word it. And I suspect that that's very often at her suggestion. So that was live editing, so to speak, but the author agreed to the editing. The texts in the so-called esoteric papers are pretty good. It's nice. When we put them in the complete works, we show the words that were crossed out and all of that, which is interesting to have. Also, because then you get a better idea of what Murshid was thinking, how he started to say it, and then how he decided to say it instead. Because I'm fascinated by every little thing about Murshid. I'm in love with him. And when you're in love with somebody, you want to know everything about them. I'm fascinated by all of these little things.
The Sangeetha papers I've seen are a little bit... They're not as organized as the...
No. Those were completed by Murshida Goodenough after Murshid died. They had only started on that project, and he only did part of them. And then Murshida Goodenough just finished them later on. And, of course, she didn't have new material to put in there. All of the Sangatas and Sangeetas are made from lectures that Murshid gave, classes that Murshid gave. And sometimes the original class was a public lecture. And then it became this higher esoteric paper, and then it was restricted. Then it was said, you know, if you don't have the whatever initiation, you can't read this, or something like that. There aren't too many people left who, you know, hold to this idea, but it was very, very strong when I started doing this work. The foundation, the Nekbat Foundation, wouldn't allow us to offer the complete works to the public. When we first began, they could only be bought. We had to get lists from the different organizations of their center leaders who had to authorize somebody to buy one of these books. And the only other place they could be sold was to research libraries, because that's really where they're intended to be, is in research libraries, so it's preserved forever what Murshid actually said. Of course, I pointed out to them that there was some slight inconsistency in this, because anybody who wanted to could go to the research library and read them, but this didn't impress them at all. So we spent a lot of useless energy restricting the sales, which, of course, like the esoteric papers themselves, the fact that they're restricted only made them far more interesting to people than they would be otherwise. And now all that's been lifted, and it's a thing of the past, happily, because that generation of people died out who had been brought up with this idea that you had to carefully guard these teachings from somebody who wasn't authorized to receive them. And to me it always seemed just ridiculous, but that's me. Yes.
They just take the shorthand and change it as they transcribed.
Not as they transcribed it. Sakina Fournet would take her shorthand and type it out, and send it to Murshida Goodenough. And Murshida Goodenough then would go over and edit it for publication. And we have those actual typescripts.
Okay.
We have it. We have the typescript. We have in Murshida Goodenough's handwriting, she crosses things out and puts something else, and you can see exactly what happened to it.
Okay, I understand that.
One aspect about the photographs is not only did you have to hold still for a long time to be photographed at all, there were no, you know, brownies came after the Second World War. That's a recent thing, a snapshot. But not only did you have to hold still, but having your photograph taken was a formal occasion, and you were supposed to look, as serious as you possibly could. Nobody had the idea you were supposed to smile for a photograph. This is a recent idea. I mean, a later idea. In fact, I think anthropologists one day, or when they dig up the remnants of the, last half of the 20th century, will say, gosh, something must have really happened in the world because everybody is smiling all the time. They must have been really, really happy people. We deliberately make people smile to take their picture, which is interesting. We have a few little recordings of Murshid speaking on the radio because radio was new in those days, you know. And he was very excited about the radio because it seemed, now you could speak and people could hear you all over the place. In fact, when he gave a Christmas message in New York in 1925, they printed it up and they wrote at the top a radio address given by Piero Murshid in Nayakhan to more than 2 million listeners. And I thought, well, how could they possibly know how many people were listening? And then I realized the 2 million figure was how many people could have listened to it at that point. And obviously they weren't all listening to it. But let's say Murshid was very excited by this technology. He saw it as something that could contribute greatly to the spreading of the message. And of course he would be even more excited by the things that are available to us now, although we also now discover the limitation of these media, which is, well, first of all, you can only take so much in, and second of all, in order to take advantage of it at all, you have to already be interested somehow, and people seem to be interested in what? Sporting events? God knows what, but not very interested in spiritual instruction, shall we say. This is not the big popular hit on TV so far, anyway. Maybe someday.
Sure. What about my question? Give us some.
The other sides of immersion. Well, when he wrote these plays and put them on, he took great delight in counter-type casting. And then would sit in the front row and laugh when this person came out and had struggled to play somebody totally different from themselves. So it's a kind of very gentle way of making fun of people, something like this, which he enjoyed.
I wonder if you have a sense beyond, obviously we all feel this tremendous commitment, and it's undeniable, but maybe you have some perception of his awareness of what he was creating.
Well, there's a very remarkable little piece that he dictated to Sakina Furnay called Organization, which appears in the biography. Those of you who haven't, please find it. You can find it on wahidudeen.net under the biography. Organization, it's called. And this is something that I didn't read till I was, deep into all of this for quite some time. And it was the most eye-opening thing, I think, that I ever read, because you actually saw the whole thing from Inayat Khan's perspective, something that had never occurred to me. I mean, even though Sufis are supposedly trained in looking at things from other people's point of view, it never occurred to me to look at the whole thing from Inayat Khan's point of view. And he expresses it extremely well, and the fact is that the whole organizational aspect of things was extremely painful to him although I think probably his Marids had very little sense of this, because he was very good at masking his pain and disappointment. It is so sobering to look at it from Murshid's viewpoint and the viewpoint of his own experience. And you realize that a lot of things you do, well-intentioned things you do as a part of the organization, actually make things difficult for the people who are really trying to accomplish something in this organization. And we're really unconscious of our own role in things, and it's very, very painful to those who really have an ideal they're trying to move toward. And we have all these niggling little dissents and all of these things. And Murshid even talks about unconscious nationalism as a major factor in the difficulty of doing his work, because the people in one country really at some level don't trust people from another country. And I think this is still very true. And I think particularly, you know, Americans and the rest of the world, we have a profound relationship of distrust with the rest of the world. And you may say, well, that's not me, that's somebody else, but it affects us all.
Is there also a sense of mission that you get from that insight into Murshid's sense of his mission?
Yeah, and the ways in which people undermine that mission, not meaning to. I mean, people very devoted to Murshid who want to support him, but they wind up pulling the rug out from under him because they just can't see themselves in a large enough context of the work that he's trying to do. And he says sometimes it was so painful to him, it was like the peeling had been taken off of his heart. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great piece. I recommend it very highly to read it if you haven't already. Yes. His disappointment, I think, was pretty much continuous throughout his time in the West. That is, he always expected something better than he got, and so was disappointed. He was not realistic in his assessment of people. He saw, it was even part of his, he deliberately did not see the negative aspects of people. He deliberately looked at their best selves and tried to think about how he could enable them to just to be their best selves and leave behind whatever was undesirable in their personality. And he thought even noticing what was undesirable made it stronger. So it's better not to think about it. It's a kind of, I think psychologists call it denial. And it's very strong in his teachings. He doesn't feel badly about it. Denial is a spiritual practice, you could say. Not looking at things which are undesirable or negative. If something is wrong with your body, let's say illness of some kind, Murshid's way of dealing with it is to give it as little conscious energy as possible. I mean, he doesn't say not to have doctors, not to have it cured, but just don't think, I am ill. It's that in itself makes you more ill if you think, I am ill. He never said to people what they expected him to say. A very good example is he'd given a lecture in which he very often mentioned Christ, which he did all the time because his audience was primarily Christian, so he made a lot of references. And after the lecture, he took questions. He always took questions, except in America. And so he took the questions, and one woman asked him the most dreadful question. That is, what do you think about the second coming? In a Christian context, this is the worst question you can have to answer, because there isn't any right answer, no matter what you say. It's like if somebody asks you about abortion. I mean, you're an idiot if you answer. You're just going to get in trouble, no matter what you say. But Murshid said, for me, he has never left. And this is an example of what he called the answer that uproots the question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't remember how I got going on that, but anyway. Yes.
Wait. You were going somewhere. You were referring to organization as in response to Lenny's question.
Oh, right. Absolutely. Yeah. The piece on organization, and it just it is so sobering to look at it from Murshid's viewpoint and the viewpoint of his own experience, and then we're really unconscious of our own role in things, and it's very, very painful to those who really have an ideal they're trying to move toward, and we have all these niggling little dissents and all of these things, and Murshid even talks about unconscious nationalism as a major factor in the difficulty of doing his work, because the people in one country really at some level don't trust people from another country. And I think this is still very true, and I think particularly, you know, Americans and the rest of the world, we have a profound relationship of distrust with the rest of the world. And you may say, well, that's not me, that's somebody else, but it affects us all.
Is there also a sense of mission that you get from that insight into Murshid's sense of his mission?
Yeah, and the ways in which people undermine that mission, not meaning to. I mean, people very devoted to Murshid who want to support him, but they wind up pulling the rug out from under him because they just can't see themselves in a large enough context of the work that he's trying to do. And he says sometimes it was so painful to him, it was like the peeling had been taken off of his heart. Well, it's a great piece. I recommend it very highly to read it if you haven't already. Yes.
Did the text of those prayers stay the same over time?
Pretty much.
And so, is that specifically written down? And
yeah, you can find that in one of the volumes of the Complete Works, the one called Sayings 1. Mm-hmm. And the one rather surprising thing is, those prayers in particular, in Icon says, they were not the product of a human mind. Mm-hmm. This is as close as he ever comes to claiming divine inspiration. And he says, therefore, don't change anything. Mm-hmm. Right? Very emphatically, don't change anything. No matter how good a reason you have to change it, don't change it. Of course, we have anyway. but the surprising thing is that if you look in the Sayings 1 book there, you will find there are some translations of Hindu songs by the Comte de Breteuil, Breteuil, that have a wording very, very similar to the prayers, and the Comte de Breteuil was an associate of Murshid's. And so it seems quite clear that the texts are based on these translations from Hindu songs, which somehow doesn't seem to tally quite exactly with their being the product of sheer inspiration. But I can't solve that problem. But Murshid was very, very clear that these were, first of all, not his invention, and second of all, that these were the prayers for this era, in the same way, perhaps, that the Islamic prayers were conveyed through Muhammad for that era. These were the prayers for this era.
Mm-hmm. Said that I come to tune the inner planes.
Tune the inner planes on this part of the planet.
That's using transference to the teacher as a way of teaching.
And in fact, he says, the smallest work I do on the inner planes is greater than all I do in the outer world. As a teacher to his murids, he taught them mainly by example, that they must develop to the point where they too can be guides to other people, murids. That they must become Murshids to murids, as well on the basis of his example. He says, you must not only give my teachings, you must adopt my way of working. So his way of working was to give lectures that were like flypaper to attract people and catch them. And then once that had happened, to take them as personal beings, including their personal lives, deeply into your heart. Murshid was always interested in every detail of the lives of the people that he guided. There was nothing too small for him to take an interest in. And this is an example of how it's love, really. You have to love the people that you're working with, this doesn't depend on their being lovable, of course. They can be anything but lovable, but you have to love them. Anyway, that's the practice of the guide, is to love the pupil and to have her best interests, ultimate best interests, the purpose of her existence, always in mind, and to make the pupil aware gradually, more and more aware of why they are here and what it is they are to do. Because nobody is here, according to Murshid, just to hang out or enjoy themselves. Everyone has a specific purpose that they are meant to accomplish in their life on earth. And their chances of actually moving toward that, because this is the only way to have fulfillment in life, is to understand your purpose and to move toward it and fulfill it. Otherwise, life will be unsatisfactory. The person must become gradually aware of what that is, because, the purpose is like the horizon. The farther you advance, the farther it recedes. I mean, what's your idea? Your idea right now of your purpose will not be your idea 2 years from now, even if you're going in exactly the right direction. It's something that evolves and changes as you move. And the guides, the teachers' role in this is always to help you to understand the next step. But he came to do something. This tuning on the inner spheres is something for the whole of humanity, and has to do with the evolution of our entire species. And in order to be able to take part in that process and help to fulfill that, because, he's left it to us. He died when he was 44 years old, and that was now 87 years ago. And so, it's left to us to carry on this work or not. If we don't do it, then it won't be done at all, probably. We're the ones. And so we have to think of our own lives in terms of somehow taking this beyond how far it has gone already. I'll tell you one story that I think is one of the most telling in this, which is that there was a Murid who came, who came to Murshid very, very interested. I'm almost certain that this was Bryn Beorse, or Shamshur, as he was later known, but I'm not absolutely certain, but I'm pretty sure. But Murshid tells about it without naming the person, of course. This young man came to him, very interested in his teachings, and they had these very wonderful conversations. And finally, one of them, Murshid in Nikon, said to this young man, "Well, wouldn't you like to be initiated?" Something he never ever said to anyone. I mean, people had to ask him to be initiated. He would never suggest it to anyone. He wasn't into proselytizing or anything of that kind. So it was a very surprising thing. And the young man said, Murshid, I mean, I'm not worthy to be initiated." And Murshid said, "Well, what do you mean?" And he said, "Oh, well, I do terrible things." And Mercer said, well, really? Well, what terrible things do you do? And he said, well, you know, I drink, I get drunk, I gamble, probably something sexual, I don't know. But anyway, he listed all these terrible things that he did. And Mershit nodded and said yes. And he said, well, I don't think that would necessarily keep you from being initiated, but could you promise me just one thing? Well, yes, Mershit, what would that be? He said, "What would you promise me not to do these things in my presence?"
Uh-oh.
And he said, well, of course, Mershit, I would never think of doing these things in your presence. And Mershit said, oh, well, then it's quite all right, and initiated him. So then, the next time, he went to do, you know, he was about to step into the bar to have a few drinks, and suddenly he felt the presence of Mershit. And this happened every time that he went to do these things that he liked to do that he himself thought were wrong. See, that's the clue. It's not that anything is wrong or right. Mershit very clearly says nothing in itself is good or bad. But it's in your attitude. And if you think it's wrong and you do it, then you need some help to get over it. And that's what his presence provided in this case. And so this is a very clear example of a way of working. And it was Mershit's way of working. By his personal input, the fact that you were associated with Mershit, the fact, I would say, that you had the incredible good fortune to connect up with Mershit somehow, means that you have to take much, much more seriously becoming the best person you can possibly be, the most effective person you can possibly be, and the person most attuned to the real purpose of your life that you can possibly be. It's a great responsibility at the same time that it's a tremendous joy. And if it weren't for the joy, the responsibility would be meaningless. It would just be, you know, another bad trip. But because of the joy, it means that the responsibility is something that you can really get behind and take seriously and make it your life's work. That's the way I look at it. He never said to people what they expected him to say. He always said something that, well, a very good example is he'd given a lecture in which he very often mentioned Christ, which he did all the time because his audience was primarily Christian, so he made a lot of references to Jesus Christ. And after the lecture, he took questions. He always took questions, except in America. His last lecture tour, he took no questions. He gave really long lectures and took no questions. I think he'd learned enough about Americans to know that a wise person would not take questions in America. But anyway, so he took the questions, and one woman asked him the most dreadful question. What do you think about the second coming? In a Christian context, this is the worst question you can have to answer because there isn't any right answer, no matter what you say. It's like if somebody asks you about abortion. I mean, you're an idiot if you answer. You're just going to get in trouble, no matter what you say. But Mershit said, for me, he has never left. And this is an example of what he called the answer that uproots the question. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what we know.
Sure.
Yes.
Would you speak a little bit about the progression of Mercer's teaching in the latter years, or across all the years? It's a rather sweeping question.
Well, let's say, I guess you could say in universalism, in that aspect of things, in realizing further and further the implications of what he was given to teach for the future of humanity, the spiritual future of humanity seemed to come upon him more and more as he went on. And he said some very interesting things about that. The most interesting one, perhaps, is that he said that he could see with absolute clarity that it was women who would lead humanity in the next steps of its evolution. And, of course, that's happening more and more, but there's still a long way to go before we could say that women are leading the world. And in my opinion, when that happens, we'll have quite a different world from the one we have. Yes?
Did Merchant keep an esoteric notebook of practices he gave to his Marines?
Yes. Well, when every Marine was initiated, they had a little pad, and he would write the practices, or somebody would write the practices, and it had a carbon. So the person would get one, and there was a carbon that was kept in there. And one interesting thing is that he always gave a phrase in English for the person to repeat. And in the book Sayings 2, we have 358 of those phrases that we were able to find that he gave as practices to individuals. We don't say to whom they were given, but we record those. And I've been trying to revive this myself. I mean, not making up sayings myself, but using the sayings that Murshid gave to give to people, and I've done it in quite a few places. It turns out it's quite easy to do. Try to narrow down to a single word what they feel is there. It is the quality they're trying to develop in themselves, and then they give it to me on a piece of paper, and then I take it in and say voodoo chants, and I get this phrase, and I'm just obvious. It's pure intuition based on nothing at all, but I get this phrase and I give it back to them as a gift. Well, what we call wazifa, name of God, not always one of the 99 or 168 or however many names there are. Not always that, not always in Arabic, sometimes Sanskrit, something else, but usually one of the names of God to people as a practice. And there was no expectation that this would ever be changed. This was not a part of his method of working. And I met people when I went to Europe in 1982 and traveled around meeting everyone I could find who had known Murshid, and the great majority of them had never had any other practice than the one he gave them at initiation. And they had been doing it for 50 or 60 years every day. And let me tell you, those people had come to embody that quality in an extraordinary way. So he did sometimes change people's practice, but it was rare. Sometimes he changed people's names. He didn't always give people a name. If they asked for one, he gave it. But if they didn't ask, he didn't necessarily give them a name. But he always gave them the purification breaths and this phrase in English and another practice to do. And that was the beginning. Of course, their guide was supposed to carry on from there. And it was only people who had the 10th initiation, Sheikh or Khalif, who were allowed to be guides in Murshid's day. Nobody with a lower initiation could guide anyone else. But of course, things were much more secretive in Murshid's day. I mean, the zikr was not given until the 9th initiation to people in those days. The singing zikr was done as a public practice in a group. The only practice Murshid ever did in a group was the singing zikr, which was introduced in the last years. But people never sat around and said together some wazifa or something of that kind. That would have been it wouldn't have occurred to him ever to do such a thing. Even Kassab was only given at the 4th initiation, and Chaval was given at the 9th initiation along with Zikr.
say a little bit something about Aura Ray Baker, his wife, a little bit more? We don't seem to know very much about her.
About Aura Ray Baker, his wife?
Yes.
Well?
Or what the Myriads thought of her, or the interaction, or anything.
Yeah. She didn't have much interaction with the Myriads. Certainly by the time they moved into Fossil Monzel, she was pretty much just took care of her children and the household. And the only interaction she had with Myriads was at dinner, when Murshid would typically invite two or three Myriads to come and have dinner with the family. Murshida Goodenough always, and she sat on his left. And as I mentioned before, he would converse with her in Persian quite often, and nobody knew what they were talking about. And people were, of course, desperately envious that she had this kind of intimacy with Murshid. But then there would be two or three other Marids who would be, on a rotating basis, invited to dinner. People only got to see Murshid for 5 minutes during the summer school each year. That was their only contact, direct contact with Murshid by the end, because there were so many people. I mean, he couldn't see. In the early days in London, every Marid used to meet with Murshid every week for an extended interview. You can imagine that, because there were just a handful of them, it was no problem. But by the end, 5 minutes a year is what you got with Murshid in the Oriental room. But you also got invited to dinner. And the children had their own little table off to the side, and they were not allowed to say anything at all, except maybe, could you please pass the salt? I mean, they weren't allowed to participate in anything that happened, which was the norm in those days. Children weren't allowed to speak to adults unless they were spoken to first. And she, of course, prepared the food, served the food, did the dishes, took care of the children, took care of Murshid's clothes, she just did everything. They didn't have servants. And, one thing I can tell you is that her children, all of them, I mean, I didn't know Noor, of course, but the other three I knew pretty well, and every single one of them would just kind of melt when she was mentioned. I mean, they just had such a love for her. And it was so touching. And, they couldn't say, they could easily talk about the greatness of their father, but they were kind of tongue-tied when it came to talking about their mother, because they just had this overwhelming emotion and this terrible feeling, because when Murshid died, first of all, she didn't believe that he had died. She refused to believe it. She thought he'd gone off into the forest somewhere to be a sannyasin. But then they all went to India together. And it was a very difficult time.
The kids too, when you say they all, the children as well.
Yes, she and the children all went to India together the next year, 1928. And it was a difficult time. Things didn't work out too well. Particularly in Baroda, they went to the family house and there were some problems there. But anyway, then when they got back to Suren after that, she more or less progressively became reclusive. She was ill a lot. She was spent most of her time shut in her dark room. And I think probably she was in a deep depression. They didn't have that term yet at that time.
And all the companions lived other places.
They lived across the street, down the street, somewhere else, and they had a difficult relationship. They weren't friendly, shall we say, exactly.
Well, the Marids with each other, or the Marids with
the companions with the wife.
The brothers.
Okay. Oh, the brothers, right?
Yeah,
the brothers.
And the wife did not get along very well, and the children remember that they were not allowed to be children. They were not allowed to play, laugh, do any of these things because, Murshid was gone, and so there was no room for mirth or joy in life. I mean, you just had to mourn. That was all you could possibly do. And, of course, they didn't feel that themselves, but from their mother it came that that was what they were supposed to do. So if they wanted to have any fun, they had to go away from home to do that. So it was a sad story, the end of her life. Of course, when the war came, the Second World War, she went to England and lived with Claire. Claire took care of her. And then when the war was over, they couldn't go back to the house. It had been occupied. The Germans took it over, but then after the war, it was turned in by the French government turned it into a hospital for foreign fighters who had been injured. So it wasn't until 1949. So she went and lived in Holland for several years, and of course that was the period in which they discovered Noor's martyrdom, and that was very heavy for everybody. And then she finally could go back into the house in 1949, and not very long after that she had an intestinal occlusion and had an operation for it, which was apparently successful, but the operation became septic and she died.
Mm-hmm. May 1st.
It's a rather sad story, her life, but she wrote poetry, she was very lively, beautiful. She was American, of course, you know, and she brought that spirit to her children. But Mershit's disappearance, that's the word they use in French for death, is il a disparu, they say. He died. That means he died. First time we saw this, we said, well, he disappeared. Hasn't anyone been looking for him? I mean, what's going on here? That's how they say it in French. So Mershit's disappearance was something that she couldn't rise above. Mahbub Khan became the head of the movement for 10 years after that. And then Ali Khan became the head for another 10 years.
It was even longer than 10, wasn't it?
Well,
49 or something like that. 40 or 49.
Yes, you're right. It was longer than 10 years. Yeah, from 29 to 1948, I think he died, something like that. And then Ali Khan for 10 years after that. But these two brothers, and also the younger brother, Mushraf Khan, who came to join them later on in America, all three of them really remained culturally Indians, even though they were in the West, in a way that Mershit did not. Mershit went across the barrier. It wasn't that he wasn't an Indian, but he thoroughly understood and accepted Western values and the Western approach to things. But they always remained, Muslim. It's a real question, Mershit's own Islam, and that's hard to assess. But let's say, outwardly, Mershit never showed any signs of being a Muslim. He didn't say prayers where anyone ever saw him. If he said his prayers, he did it internally. He didn't fast during Ramadan. He had no interest in going to Mecca. I mean, he wasn't a Muslim in any practical meaning of the word. But his brothers always remained connected to their source in that way, and never quite made the bridge into being Westerners. So it had to be the next generation that made that move.
Folks, it's time to stop now.
Thanks again for being here. It's really an utter joy for me to be able to talk about my favorite subject.